Hello and welcome to Not a Fire Preview First, a podcast that takes one person from one side of the Iron Curtain and one person from the other side of the Iron Curtain and puts them together in the hopes of advancing world peace.
I'm Lindsay, and I use she, her pronouns.
And I'm Tanner, they, them. And this week, Lindsay, I hear that you're bringing us Two Man, Two Uncle.
Yeah, I'm going to use a term that the guys from Are You Afraid of the Dark Universe have used, which is a requel. I'm doing a requel to 2015 Guy Ritchie, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. film. Like, it was a great film, and then we discovered something about a certain actor.
Yeah, it was a great film that didn't get a sequel that it deserved, and then also,
yeah.
Then we were like, maybe it's a good thing that it didn't get a sequel.
Yeah! Like, the failure at the time, I think, was more due to, like, this is a little, like, Cold War spy comedy film. It's not quite a comedy. It's like a action film with some comedic aspects. In 2015, against the juggernaut that was the MCU.
Right.
Like, it easily got drowned out, really.
Yeah.
And then Armie Hammer turned out to be a fucking freak. And not in a fun way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
He's the kind of guy who I would adore if he was fictional. But apparently he was like... Apparently he was like, I want to be a real Lestat in real life.
Again, it's fine when it's a book. It's not fine when you want to do it for real.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have come up with a plan that the story itself will be a sequel to the 2015 film. I am keeping Guy Ritchie as the director because I think he had the best handle on it when it came to the story, the aesthetics, and what he wanted to do with the characters, except we're going to make this a bit more queer. And one of the first orders of business is who the fuck is replacing Armie Hammer?
Yes, so I see here, in the primer, you sent me a list of men who are tall and men who are short.
Yes, because here's the thing, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie is based off of a TV series that ran from, let me get to the right Wikipedia page, 1964 to 1967. Or 1968, yeah. And the actor who played Ilya Kuryenko, who is Armie Hammer's character in the movie, was David McCallum. David McCallum was very short. So I came up with two lists of actors, because, like, I know that there's a wealth of the Hollywood leading men type, and they tend to be on the tall side, but I'm also like, hey, what if we did get a shorter actor to play Ilya? And wouldn't it be funny if you have huge Henry Cavill and regular size Alicia Vikander and a short actor?
And I was surprised to learn that Henry Cavill was 6'1", because I assumed he was a short king, and Armie Hammer was a normal man. You know, in multiple ways.
Yeah, no, Henry Cavill is 6'1", and Armie Hammer is 6'5".
Yeah. So here, okay, so I will say, off your list, read the list, and then I'll tell you.
Yeah, we'll go through the list. So in regular tall guy section, I got Matt Smith. He's probably better off as a villain just because of his face, really. And he's kind of making a name for himself.
Yeah, have you seen him?
Yeah, I've watched a lot of stuff with him in it. He is villain-coded, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I threw him in there because, like, it might be a good way to avoid typecasting. It might be a good option.
I don't think he does, though, is the thing. I don't think Matt Smith wants to avoid typecasting. I think now that he's done with Doctor Who, I think he wants to play, not Scrungly. What's the tall version of Scrungly? Gangly? He wants to play gangly freaks.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what he's aiming for.
Okay, yeah. Well, he's currently playing one of the... You know what? It's a Game of Thrones spinoff. I don't think you can really say anyone is the villain.
But isn't he playing, like, one of the absolute weirdos of the family?
Yeah, he's currently fucking his niece? Yeah. And that's, like, the least weird thing he's done. I got Luke Grimes because... Yeah, more American... Cowboy, whatever. It would be funny if there was a bit of a in-universe joke about that. I just threw him in because, like, good-looking, blonde, tall guy. Chris Hemsworth. I was just like, huh, that would be interesting. Could he do a Russian accent around that Australian accent?
I don't know. I don't think he could. I'm going to say right now, I don't think he's capable.
Yeah. Jack Loudon, probably our best option if we were going for a taller guy.
Das Vidanya! Yeah, and he's, out of the tall guys, my pick is Jack Loudon.
Yeah. My other option was Ryan Reynolds, because, like, for whatever reason, Armie Hammer looks kind of like Ryan Reynolds. Just, like, a cheaper version of him.
I would be incapable of taking Ryan Reynolds seriously.
Okay, after the Barbie movie, it's just like, yeah, you're...
He was not in the Barbie movie.
Oh, no.
Are you thinking of Ryan Gosling?
Yeah, I was thinking of Ryan Gosling. There's too many Ryans.
I will say, because Hammer also looks a bit like a knockoff of Ryan Reynolds, I will give you that.
Yeah.
Also, here's the thing. Actually, Ryan Gosling... The issue I would have with Ryan Gosling isn't that I wouldn't be able to take him seriously, because like he was acting in the Barbie movie, you see.
Yeah.
He's not normally like that.
Yeah.
But however, the thing is, Ryan Gosling is that when he's in a movie like this, like, after seeing him in stuff like, I have not seen Drive, but I've seen clips of Drive, and that's why I'm still normal to a degree.
Yeah.
But like, he's too pulled together, and it's like, if we were starting from scratch, he would be in my running for playing solo.
Yeah. So out of the tall guys is probably Jack Loudon. Out of the short kings, James McAvoy. Don't know about the hair.
No. Too wiry.
Daniel Radcliffe.
Too weird. I think he and Matt Smith should be in a movie together playing competing weirdos.
Yeah, okay. The Harry Potter movies did something to him. Taron Egerton, because, like, he has been in a spy film before, but this would be... It's obvious, but also, like, it...
It would be different, but it's, like, the same flavor as Kingsman.
Yeah. My other thing against Taron Egerton is that he was in a movie with Alicia Vikander called The Testament of Youth. It wasn't a well-known movie because it's a historical drama. They don't get a lot of attention except around Oscar season, and they don't even think A Testament of Youth is in the running for any sort of Oscars.
Yeah.
It's just, if you're one of the girlies who know about A Testament of Youth, you know that they played siblings. And it might be a bit awkward to have them play people who are supposed to be in love with each other.
I don't think it would, because this is a separate film.
That's true. It's just like, if you already know about that movie, yeah. I'm leaning towards Jack Loudon. Just also because, like, when it comes to the actual mechanics of filming, having the big height disparities between actors can get awkward.
Yeah.
As I said, Alicia Vikander is actually average size. It's just like everybody else around her is tall.
The other thing going for Jack Loudon is that he is probably as beefy as Armie Hammer was.
Yeah.
So he would still be able to match the physicality.
Yeah, that's the other thing is...
Also, if you find a picture of him without the facial hair, he does look very Ilya-coded.
Yeah. And he's in a somewhat popular TV show, and he's done action before, so...
Okay, yeah, let's go with Jack Loudon.
Okay. So... The plot is cribbed together from, like, 6 different episodes. But mostly episodes using fairly similar plots or having similar plot elements. They all share, like, a mad scientist roping in some random civilian to help out was fairly standard for the TV show.
Yes.
And a lot of chemical weapons for nefarious uses.
Yeah, so that was the thing. So the episodes you told me to, the episodes you cited were the Finny Foot Affair and the Neptune Affair, which are both about basically bioterrorism.
Yeah.
The King of Knaves Affair, which was about, the King of Knaves Affair says Solo poses as an arms dealer in an attempt to scupper the plans of a deposed ruler who is hoping to return to power by building an army of high-profile criminals. Which, that sounds like you're just using that plot to recreate Thrush. Essentially?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll talk about Thrush in a bit. To Trap a Spy and The Vulcan Affair were kind of like the pilots that were turned into TV movies, which like introduced Thrush, but the acronym worked out differently. It just had Solo in it, because Ilya didn't become a regular until like, I think, halfway through the first season.
Yeah.
He was one of those ensemble Dark Horse characters. Anyway, The Vulcan Affair, which is, yeah, it's what I'm mostly cribbing from. There's this evil scientist and a senior operative for Thrush who is involved in, like, creating chemical weapons and, what was the other one? The Vulcan Affair and To Trap a Spy. That one involved the housewife knowing the evil scientist, and they were trying to stop an assassination attempt against the prime minister of a newly independent African country. And, like, there's a whole bunch of back and forth, and, like, people aren't who they say they are. Or, like, their motives are kind of, like, murkier or all that. And, yeah.
Yeah. Because in your primer, I also... Okay, so you said episode 113. I think you may have done a typo, because I think you meant episode 103.
Yeah.
Because that's the one where it's talking about Agassin states, induces a state of fear and anxiety.
Yeah.
Which also sounds like something you're talking about for your plot. Also, that sounds a lot like the first season of Agent Carter.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe they're a little bit inspired. Maybe, I don't know, maybe...
A little bit of both, yeah.
Peggy Carter is kind of the woman from S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
Sorry, one more tangent I have to mention.
Okay.
Because the other episode you cite is The Deadly Games Affair, which you've clearly cited because it introduces the thrush villainess Angelique, who sort of has a complex romantic relationship. And we love a complex romantic relationship, especially if it's with a woman named Angelique. very much bypassing the fact that this A-plot for this episode is that an SS scientist is attempting to reanimate the body of Hitler.
Yeah! I'm just like, that's a little...
Because it was the 60s, you just...
You just did shit like that. There's a B-movie that is called They Kept Hitler's Head, or they Resurrected Hitler's Head or something.
Everyone's always in favor of saving Hitler's brain, but when you put it into a great white shark, oh, sure!
Yeah. I just kept Angelique. Everything else about that episode, I'm like... Nah, that's too much. We're trying to be more James Bond here. Even though James Bond had that whole, like, one plot in one of its movies where, like, the Bond girl had psychic powers as long as she was a virgin, and...
What?!
Yeah.
Damn, just like Lady Gaga.
Anyway, the general plot is that there's a deadly chemical that was used on a village in Scotland that turns out to be the final experiment testing this new chemical weapon. Our team of Napoleon Solo, Ilya Kuryakin, and Gabby Teller are tasked with investigating, like, what this is, what it's supposed to be doing. Then it turns out that the chemical was made in a fictional West African country. Like, we can discuss whether or not we want this to be a real place or stick with the fictional country of Western Natumba. How do you feel about that?
The only reason Wakanda gets away with it is because it's, like, the great bastion of mainstream Afrofuturism.
Yeah.
And I feel like, in general, it is a weird thing to, like, invent fictional countries in the global south, because then you can kind of get away with doing whatever you want to them.
Yeah.
Because they're not real. So you're not actually offending people. So on the other hand, this is a country where we're not screwing over. Like, we're intentionally, like, trying to have it so that it is a success story by the end, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like, on the other hand, it's that it is being saved by the actions of three white people and a guest star.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how I feel about that, because it does kind of come off as like, well, you would have failed in your quest for independence. It's not for these three attractive white people.
Yeah.
But also, we don't want to say that three attractive white people were behind a real-life African country getting independence.
Now, do we just want to move this to Europe, then?
I think it's important to keep it in Africa because it keeps a more global perspective for the series.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately I'm not going to say it's damned if you do, damned if you don't, because I think the way we're putting it is that we're treating the subject with grace. It's just that there are downsides to each version.
Yeah. Like, if anything, like, if this were an actual production, I would have just written out the outline and I would have handed it to someone who could actually, like, do this justice.
Yes. And I think for the purposes of this podcast, which is, we may not be brainstorming fan fiction anymore, but we are still brainstorming stories.
Yeah.
Because we haven't reached Are You Afraid of the Dark Universe levels yet, where we are just reading out the entire premise.
I would die if I had to write a script.
That's why, like, if we reopen a Patreon, that would be one of the rewards, that you've contributed to helping us write a script.
Yeah.
Also, I did die when I wrote a script. I wrote Jurassic Park, remember?
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I think for the purpose of this podcast, we can keep it in the... Where was the... What did you name the nation? Did you name the nation, or did the nation come from Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
It came from Man from U.N.C.L.E. It's called Western Natumba.
Okay, I think we can keep it with Western Natumba for the purposes of our show. And then, yeah, if we were to actually get this into production somehow, or even if we got the rights to, like, publish it as a tie-in novel or something, we would put it through a sensitivity reader just to say, like, hey,
yeah,
which direction would be ideal?
Yeah. Because, like, I want to maintain the agency of our non-white characters, because I also, part of me was thinking, like, I want to avoid the series being hella white.
Yeah.
And this is the Cold War, and one of the things that happened during the Cold War is all of these, like, proxy conflicts and, like, the CIA and various, and the KGB trying to, like, influence various countries in the global south to do certain things a certain way.
Exactly.
None more complicated than say, like, the Angolan Civil War, where it's like, one side was being funded by the CIA and getting military advisory help from North Korea at the same time. And everybody knew about this. But that's, like, later in the Cold War. We're still in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Lindsay problem of me not figuring out how to fucking end this. Like, I know that some of this stuff can be summarized and all that. It's just like, ugh, what have I gotten myself into? Anyway, the opening scene will be, like, this tiny village in the Outer Hebrides. Not a lot of people, about 150 people. They're all going to bed. It's late at night.
Is that how it's pronounced?
The Outer Hebrides? Yeah.
I always thought it was the Hebrides.
There isn't that extra E.
Okay, the Hebrides. Good to know.
Yeah, Hebrides. So anyway, they get wiped out by this chemical weapon. So when I was initially outlining this, I originally put in a chemical called Tabin, which was developed pre-World War II and was experimented on by the Nazis. It's kind of like sarin gas. It just works a little bit differently.
Okay.
Like, on the one hand, the first Man from U.N.C.L.E. movie, just the nuclear weapons that were being made inside of the castle. On the other hand, it doesn't feel great to have, like, it wouldn't be graphically depicted, but, like, this stuff is real. And it has real world effects, and it's been stuff like this, like sarin gas has been used fairly recently. So it's like, I don't know how I feel about actually depicting that. So maybe I go for the more fantastic and pull from one of the plots in the TV series and have the madness inducing or like the panic inducing gas that maybe it doesn't kill everybody in the village, but it does cause several deaths or like it causes people to attack other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the ideas I pulled from was this mass poisoning incident that happened in France in 51. Called the Pont Saint-Esprit mass poisoning.
Okay.
That was attributed to ergot poisoning. Basically, the ergot mold got into the bread that was being made in the town, and I guess enough people ate the bad bread that day that they all had a bad trip.
Oh no.
Diarrhea, vomiting, and headaches. Similar symptoms were reported in Laval-Saint-Romain. Multiple families reported sick in Goudargues and Le Mont-du-Rhône.
Oh no!
Yeah, just a lot of people got sick, and people were hallucinating. And there's a conspiracy theory that the mass poisoning might have been caused by the CIA, because this lines up with a lot of the LSD experiments that the CIA was conducting at the time. And there was chemical and biological warfare testing going on in Europe at the time by the CIA. And just some of the symptoms line up with like a bad LSD trip.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's kind of what I was going on with. Instead of having to ingest it, they could just breathe it in. It's like aerosolized LSD, but like really bad LSD.
Okay.
LSD, for the most part, won't hurt you. Anyway, go to opening credits, and then we have, like, the action scene, because I think this is a film that should start off with an action scene, and we get to see, like, where our main trio is at.
Okay, let's put them in Spain.
Portugal.
Okay, let's put them in Portugal.
Yeah, Lisbon is the capital of Portugal.
You did say Lisbon, I just glossed over it briefly. They're pursuing a scientist who's got Hitler's brain.
They're pursuing an arms dealer that is going to tie into the whole main plot.
Yeah.
And it's mostly, as I've been trying to say, like, demonstrate where the characters are at and how they're working together. Because, like, Gabby is obviously, like, the getaway driver, the wheel woman, doing all of the Fast and the Furious style stunts. I think she would be a good member of the Totoro family.
Yeah.
I think Solo is pretty much the same from the first movie. Like, he's still, like, the face guy. I think Ilya is the one who is probably going to be changing the most, like, aside from having a new actor. As he said in that one conversation, this movie is only going to do one lampshade joke.
Exactly. It's you follow the rules established in Iron Man 2. You get one scene of Don Cheadle coming up and saying, yes, it's me, let's not worry about it.
Yeah. And, like, I think the big thing with Ilya, so in the first movie, kind of like his recurring character flaw is his temper and how people manipulate that temper. And I think one of the things that maybe should be a through line for his character is him figuring out how to, like, better handle the temper.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, his anger in the movie kind of gives him superpowers. Like, he goes into a bit of a berserker mode. Like, the first car chase scene involves him, like, running to catch up with the little Trabant that Gabby is driving.
Yeah.
Managing to get a hold of...
He already knows how to channel his rage. It's just that he doesn't always know when to start channeling his rage.
Yes. Yeah.
Doesn't help that Solo spends, like, the first half of the first film nagging him, kind of.
Yeah, now that I think about it, like, the development in their relationship is, like, Solo being less of a shit to Ilya.
Mm-hmm.
Not constantly poking him. That's the big thing. Because sometimes Ilya is kind of a puppy and he wants to impress people with all of his skills.
Also, to mirror the opening of the first film, in this film we should have Ilya stopping the fleeing car with his bare hands.
Yes.
Actually, no, that's what our joke can be. Like, Gabby is chasing down the, like, arms dealer's car and, like, winding through the streets doing extremely stressful driving that is shaking up Solo. Because it's not a joke about woman drivers and what she expects. It's
yeah.
The problem isn't that you're a woman driver. The problem is I'm pretty sure you're going to drive us off a bridge. And then she'll be like, I'm only going to do that if they do it first.
Yeah.
And then Ilya will come out of nowhere and just, like, grab the side of the car and is strong enough to, like, slow it down. Like, it skids, almost starts doing a donut.
Yes.
Then, like, afterwards, and they get the dealer. Wait, do they get the dealer, or does the dealer get away?
The dealer isn't really that important, so yeah, let's just say that they get the dealer.
Okay, so they get the dealer, and then Gabby and Solo catch up, and Solo can crack something about, like, oh, the car must have hit you, that's why your face looks like that. And he goes, like, my face always looks like this. And so I was like, walked into that one, bud. And that's our one!
Yeah, that is the one reference! Then we go back to Uncle HQ, we get the briefing with Waverly, who's Hugh Grant's character.
Yes.
I had completely missed him the first time I had seen Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Really?
Until, like, the very end.
Because, well, he doesn't really show up until the very end.
Yeah, like, he briefly shows up and you don't see his face in the first act.
Oh, that's
and
right.
Then at the party scene, like, he's kind of there as kind of a distraction, and, like, if you're watching this for the first time, you're probably just thinking, oh, it's a cameo, whatever. Especially if you have no knowledge of the TV show. You don't know a thing about Alexander Waverly and how he is actually rather important. So, anyway, they get the briefing about the massacre at the Scottish village and leftover canisters, and, like, they present their clue. Stuff is starting to match up, and I was thinking that there had been a similar, like, weird panic attack at, like, a political rally in Western Natumba, which is a soon-to-be independent nation. Or, you know what? Scratch that. It's already independent. It's just, like,
all the fuss that comes after that, basically.
Yeah. This is, like, year 3 or something.
It's like they're independent on paper, but like all the European powers, now America as a power, they're like, but are you really independent? Do you need to be that independent?
They're independent, except for their economy. So anyway, the attack happened during like the independence referendum campaign, just as Sukui Ashman, who's a major independence leader and recently elected to the presidency. So he's one of the characters from To Catch a Spy. So it happened when he was there, and weird panic happens, stampede happens. It's a mess, but like, it's not that bad. It's not enough to kill this independence movement.
Big thing about Ashman is that one of his goals is to nationalize Western Ntumba's few industries, which includes a major chemical plant. Many leaders in the West don't like this because they've got a lot of money invested in it.
Mm-hmm. I do think we may have skipped ahead a little bit, so let's just do a quick rewind so we can make sure we hit all the notes you've written down here. Also, I think we should address that you're basically going into this with the goal of putting these characters into a throuple, and like, from what I understand, Solo and Ilya both had a kind of a something-something going on in the original series.
Yeah, and Ilya and Gabby were supposed to do the tried-and-true fake engaged.
Yes, and that's the thing. Okay, so when I say original, I mean the original series, because it's like, let's just say that Star Trek TOS was not the only series to have a premise, if you know what I mean.
Yeah!
But also, Gabby, who is a character originally created for the Guy Ritchie film, is kind of the secret sauce that kind of balances the dynamic between them.
Yeah, like, Ilya has all of these hard edges, Solo is the smooth operator, and, like, Gabby can see through both of them.
Yes. You also, one of the things you mentioned is that before they're dispatched to Ntumba, is that we established that both Solo and Ilya's handlers, because they're both essentially on loan to Uncle, which right now is basically Waverly's pet project.
Yeah. And I was thinking, like, I had set this, like, a year after the first movie, so, like, I don't think Uncle is, like, as independent as Waverly wants it to be, yet.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm looking at this one spot where you've got, establishing what the current status quo was at Uncle is basically what we need to do.
Yeah.
Like, we'll have the opening action scene, then we'll have some stuff that establishes, like, just kind of what's up with Ntumba, and then we'll use that to segue into the status quo being set up at Uncle.
Yeah.
And we establish that they're both, not technically, neither of them are truly men from Uncle, and Gabby is not a woman of Uncle either. They're just kind of there.
Yeah.
And the handlers are still, like, trying to get them to betray each other. So there's tension. I don't think there's tension between them as much as tension of the fact, like, they're wondering how long we can keep this up, essentially.
Yes. It's not antagonism, it's outside pressure.
It's concern, because, like,
yeah.
Yeah, we need to establish, like, that the three of them are committed to each other as partners, but also they're committed to these missions because they believe in Waverly's goal of, like, stopping a growing arms race between the world's superpowers.
Yeah.
So the scene popped up in my head, because another thing you mentioned is, like, wanting to establish, again, that Ilya's anger issues, he's managing them. So I have the scene that's taking place in, like, a gym at the Uncle headquarters, where they're just doing standard, like, punching the bag, and bringing up how, like, their handlers keep coming after them. And I'm thinking, while we do this, like, Solo takes, like, something that we see one of his handlers give him something, and Solo takes that something and he takes a bug off of it, and he hands it to Ilya, who just casually punches it and destroys it while he's doing the punching bag. And then they switch sides, and then Solo does the same to the bug that Ilya hands him. And then also, like, for comedy's sakes, they turn to Gabby and they're like, hey, have the Italians been having any bugs planted on you? And she's like, I am the Italian bug. And there's, like, a pause as they're a little bit concerned, like, did she pull it faster on us? And then she's like, they don't pay me enough to actually tell them anything.
Okay, a couple corrections. Gabby is German and she's working for the British. Because Waverly is British.
Oh, that's right, but her uncle was working with the Italians.
Yeah, because they're all part of this fascist underground. We'll eventually discuss Thrush. And sort of like where they're coming from.
Right, okay, yeah, because Gabby would probably know, I don't know if Gabby would know about Thrush, but she'd probably know enough about the people who were involved in it that she could get some insight to it.
She knows people.
Gabby's definitely going to know the guy who's being played by your special boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because also, like, on my second viewing, like, when I, when I remembered that Uncle Rudy is also the torturer in that one scene near the climax, that, like, okay, what the fuck is up with her family? Like, aside from the whole Nazi thing, like, she just seems to come from a super fucked up family, and there's, like, this passing reference to her having a foster father who probably is the guy who taught her how to be a mechanic.
Yeah.
Because also, for people who haven't seen the original movie, Gabby's whole thing is, like, aside from being a driver, she's also a mechanic.
Yeah.
She forces one of the bad guys because she, like, knows how to, like, handle cars.
Yeah. I think also, if there's a safe-cracking scene, it should be Gabby who's doing the safe-cracking, because it makes more sense for her to have more knowledge of the engineering stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it doesn't make sense for Ilya and Solo to have knowledge of it. It's just, like, it's more in her wheelhouse.
Well, kind of, sort of, because Solo started as an art thief. He's, like, the boss crook for the CIA. They kind of cornered him, and that's going to come up in the second act. But, like, of course, he knows how to crack, like, the really sophisticated safes. But, like, I think Gabby can handle a lot of the engineering stuff. Ilya apparently has a background in physics, which could be useful for some later Act 2 stuff. It's just Solo is the arts major.
Yeah.
And also the other thing is, like, during the chase scene, I want to, like, have someone that Napoleon Solo sees. And he recognizes, and it's going to be Angelique, and I cast Sophia Boutella for that role.
Yes, and so is he seeing her at Uncle HQ?
No, I was thinking a bit earlier, and it kind of just sticks with him that, like, he doesn't say anything, but, like, I think Ilya and Gabby, knowing him, should notice, like, hey, something's up. Or, like, you're acting distracted.
Maybe he sees her in Lisbon, like, on a balcony, and he has to do a double take, and then she's gone.
Yeah. And, like, the thing about Solo, too, is that he's the womanizer of the group. Or, like, as the face, he's the one who does all of the seduction stuff. So, like, they're used to, like, a parade of women coming through.
Yeah.
But they've never seen him react to a woman like that. Anyway, yeah, so I skipped ahead to, like, establishing the whole Western Matumba situation. This is also, like, where we would introduce our civilian character. Civilian in quotation marks, like, she works for Uncle. I'm calling her Dr. Elaine Donaldson. She is another character from the series, a one-off character, and she was a housewife there, and I'm like, let's make her a chemist.
Yeah.
Because as I said, like, Ilya has a physics background. Gabby has basically a mechanical engineering background. Solo probably knows some basics regarding chemistry, because he was an art thief, and as someone who works in archives, you have to know a surprising amount of chemistry, but not, like, bioweapons and chemical weapons level of
right.
knowledge and chemistry. And I think having someone there to be like, the technical advisor would be good. And, like, they go to Scotland with her, and she's the one who figures out, okay, this is what happened. This is, like, what the chemical is doing. And we can deduce where it came from, which gets us to Western Matumba, finally. And then I was thinking of throwing in, like, a reference to Patrice Lumumba, because this would have been a fairly recent event. He was the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, who he was assassinated in a coup that was backed by Belgium, the US, and the UK. It was revealed during the church committee that the CIA chief, Alan Dulles, had ordered Lumumba's assassination. And then in a 2001 report from Belgium, they found that Cindy Gottlieb, who was head of MKUltra and was called the poisoner-in-chief of the CIA, had made a toxin specifically to kill Lumumba. Lumumba himself actually died at the hands of the firing squad. The original plan was to poison him with his toothpaste. So, yeah, like, I think Waverly making that reference and being like, hey, can we avoid that situation? Because the Congo has now descended into this whole crisis that lasts for a very long time.
Yeah. And then, of course, they're going to get the separate brieflings from each of their handlers saying, hey, can we try and invoke this kind of situation in the Western Matumba? Because then we can seize control.
Yeah. So, like, Solo's handler, Sanders, who's played by Jared Harris, doing, like, it's weird to hear Jared Harris do an American accent, because I've seen him where he's just using his regular British accent.
And see, for me, who I first saw Jared Harris on Fringe, where he was an American accent, so it's weird for me when I hear him doing British things.
Okay. Anyway, like, his orders to Solo a simple, like, make sure that chemical plant stays within American hands. Ilya, like, I came up with a bit more elaborate, like, hey, there's a scientist who escaped from our clutches. This Nazi scientist that the Soviets had captured. Yeah, the Soviets had their own version of Project Paperclip, but instead of, like, enticing former Nazi scientists to come over with, like, we're gonna whitewash your past and give you, like, a nice house and cushy jobs, the Soviets are basically kidnapped a bunch of people and then, like, kept them all isolated and sort of erased them and assign achievements to other people. Anyway, one of the scientists by the name of Wolfgang Amadeus Wolf, he was originally named Wolp in one of the episodes I'd referenced, and I'm like, that's a lame-ass name. Wolp. So I switched it to Wolf. Bet on the nose, whatever.
Yeah, so now his name is Wolfgang Amadeus Wolf, which is such a badass name. It's ridiculous.
He doesn't use it. He's going by Andrew Vulcan, who's played by my Blorbo Daniel Brühl.
Your specialist boy.
I know, he's a German actor, he's going to play Nazis, that's kind of the lot in life of a German actor now. So yeah, Ilya's told, hey, this guy escaped, could you just, like, get rid of him and also, like, fuck over your American counterpart so that, you know, we have a justification to send our people to Western Ntumba and make things better? And that's where we introduce our villains. So you know that mysterious woman that Napoleon recognized and was distracted by for a hot second? She lands on a helipad at the chemical plant in Western Ntumba, with a big thrush sign painted on one of the smokestacks, and goes to speak with her boss. This woman is being played by Sophia Boutella. We're going to reveal that her name is Angelique. So in her original TV version, she wasn't given a last name. I gave her the last name of Enriquez. So she goes to talk to her boss, who is played by Daniel Brühl. He's playing a guy called Dr. Andrew Vulcan. That's not his real name. He's actually Wolfgang Amadeus Wolf. I completely forgot that the name, it's ridiculous. Anyway, he assures her, like, she tells him about the whole, like, situation in Lisbon with the disruption to the arms deal. He tells her that, like, it's gonna be fine, we'll just, like, do something a bit differently once things settle down. She brings up that our heroes were the ones who did it, reminds him that they were the ones that took out the Vinciguerras from the first movie. So a bit of a recap on them. They were the Italian shipping heirs who were secretly Nazis, and, like, the dad was funding a lot of fascist stuff and was alleged to have smuggled out a lot of Nazi gold to South America and Nazis themselves to South America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cliched as all hell. This has been a plot thing since the 60s, but that's how we established Thrush. So they're, like, the recurring bad guys. In the pilot film, they were called Wasp. The original series never divulged who or what Thrush represented, nor was it ever used as an acronym. In the novel written by David McDaniel, it's explained that it stands for Technological Hierarchy for the Removal of Undesirables and the Subjugation of Humanity, described as having been founded by Colonel Sebastian Moran after the death of Professor Moriarty at the Reichenbach Fall in the Sherlock Holmes story, The Final Problem. But in a second season episode, guest star Jesse Royce Landis plays a character who claims that she founded Thrush, but one of the producers insisted that Thrush was not an acronym and stood for nothing. They're kind of like the man from Uncle's version of Spectre.
Yeah.
So, like, I just made them remnant Nazis because, like, that was kind of what the Vinciguerra backstory was kind of leaning towards.
Not to mention stealing Hitler's brain and reanimating him.
I mean, nobody actually knows what happened to Hitler's corpse, so, yeah.
So what? It's still out there? It's still kicking?
It's probably at the bottom of a mine shaft somewhere in Germany.
Yeah.
Or flattened under a parking lot. Anyway, Vulcan actually takes this whole bit seriously and tells Angelique to keep her eye on this. And that's where we introduce President Ashiman, who I have cast Chiwetel Ejiofor. Also, Dr. Elaine Donaldson. I have Nicole Beharie in it because I think she deserves the world.
Yes, same. Agree.
So anyway, Chiwetel Ejiofor is going to play our Ashaman. We're going to have a scene in like formally introducing him, where he's talking with representatives of Thresh, or like not Thresh themselves, but he knows that they're associated with Thresh, and they want to negotiate, in big quotation marks, a deal to keep the chemical plant in private ownership that would benefit Western Nantumba, and Ashaman tells him to get lost. While chewing them out for all the wrongs they've committed against the people of Western Nantumba, like not paying people and no health and safety standards, etc., etc., ad nauseam.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think there's stuff that I put into Act Two where I'm like, I could put that into Act One and just like focus on like the big thing in Act Two is like getting access to this chemical plant, seeing what the production. Like, how far along they are in production of this new chemical weapon. Get some exposition on, like, how this chemical weapon was created. How Vulcan created it. And what the ultimate goal is going to be. All the while, like, revealing some stuff about Elaina and Ashaman. Because I'm like, hey, what if they were, like, the two black people on the Columbia campus in, like, the late 30s? That would be interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I had a love plot, but I'm like, that's a bit too cliched. What if they were just, like, really good friends?
Yeah, I think, because making it a romance plot would make it, like, just another thing
cliche.
On top of all the other stuff we need to accomplish in this film with the main trio, and yeah, kind of cliche. I think making them friends makes a lot of sense, because it also means that he's more willing to trust, if he's willing to trust her, he's willing to trust the rest of Uncle.
Yeah.
And so it, like, it's one less thing that they need to worry about, and well, like, we can just say, yeah, he trusts them, so we can bypass any questions about why, necessarily, he's doesn't have concern about these people coming in and fretting about him.
Yeah. Like, I think he'll have minor concerns, but, like, knowing that Elaine trusts them, like, there is no way that a Thresh One facility is going to let Elaine walk in as, like, oh, I'm just an inspector looking into your facility to make sure everything is, you know, doing whatever. Or, like, I'm a visiting scientist, etc., etc. I think, like, she's gonna... We do have established walkie-talkies. I think, like, she should be guiding Solo, Gabby, and Ilya through earpieces, because, like, she's the chemistry expert, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there should be, like, an infiltration scene where Elaine is guiding at least Solo and Ilya through the chemical plant.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Other stuff we can look at for Act 2 would be, like, what kind of conflicts are going on.
I think the other conflicts that come up, because Angelique is going to be, like, the main henchwoman that they are fighting, and Solo is like, why are you working for Thresh? And we don't have to give, like, the biggest backstory ever, but, like, establish what the backstory is. And, like, my general thought is, like, they were partners. And knowing these three, they were probably lovers. She stabbed him in the back, which led to his whole capture and CIA deal. But I also kind of want to drop hints that Angelique might have her own agenda going on. That she isn't just an obedient henchwoman. With Ilya, it's more like he's dealing with the pressure from his handler and is trying to make things work. Also, again, we're dealing with Nazis, and I don't know if, like, Vulcan slash Wolf would know Gabby personally, but I think he would know her family.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, there's always that question of, like, where does Gabby's loyalties lie? And I think this is the movie where it, like, it's finally established, no, I am loyal to you three guys. I am totally against everything that my family had stood for. It's just the whole, like, again, her family is, like, deep into this whole, like, Nazi shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to always be this weight around her, I think. It's just, like, how does she handle this and, like, her having to finally prove, like, I'm not going to betray you at any point. I think, like, the big action scenes are going to be, like, infiltrating the plant. There needs to be a couple fight scenes where Angelique is kind of doing stuff that is both, like, against our team, but also, like, she might be undermining her bosses. We're going to get Angelique's backstory probably late in the second act. And then there's, I think it should be capped off with, like, probably Elaine is the one who gets taken hostage because she's the non-combat person. But I think she should be, like, the hostage who could get herself out of the situation or can at least, like, figure out a way to turn this to her advantage.
I think we can even go further in that. I would say that she lets herself get taken hostage.
Oh, yeah.
Because if she's being taken hostage, that's how she's able to get... That's how she's able to walk right into the chemical plant.
Yeah.
And we can say that Gabby gave her a gadget that lets her get out.
Yeah.
And then she can be the woman on the inside while the three of them hammer their way in from the outside.
Yeah.
Also, I have an idea for Angelique's backstory, but I think it's something we can bring up, like... near the end of the third act, like it's almost a sequel series, or a sequel hook.
Yeah.
But, so, I want to save it till the end.
Okay.
The third act kind of writes itself, because this is an action movie, so, like, again, we don't have to go into super detail, but we can say that, and then action scene, and they win.
Yeah, it's more like, what is the action set? I was also thinking, like, for the Billy the Will situation, I think the other point might be, like, have an assassination attempt on Ashman that looks successful.
I like that, too. Because then it's almost... It goes into kind of the Guy Ritchie did not direct Ocean's 11. But there's a little bit of a heisty, capery vibe to a lot of his projects.
Yeah.
And I think doing that, like doing the double blind of Angelique going, like letting herself be taken hostage and Ashman being alive all along, gives it a bit of a caper angle
that feeds
into this whole, I don't know what kind of drink this is. Because it's not a martini or a dirty beer.
Because there was also a scene in the first movie where Napoleon got his drink was spiked that he made when he was visiting Victoria Vichigera. She had spiked all of the drinks on the drinks table. And, God, like, Henry Cavill is actually a really good comedic actor in, like, having that very dry wit. Because, like, his character, Solo, like, arranges pillows on this couch so that, and Victoria's like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I know that you poisoned me, so I'm, like, making a comfortable spot so I don't hurt myself when I fall.
Yeah.
Again, it's much funnier to see than how I'm explaining it, but, like, that's the thing about Henry Cavill and, like, what, like, Zack Snyder didn't get. But I think Henry Cavill could have been a good Superman if they had allowed Henry Cavill to be funny.
Exactly. Well, even then, though, because, like, Superman, when Superman is funny, it's a different kind of humor than Cavill does, because Superman is kind of, he's bumbling funny. That's kind of why Tyler Hoechlin plays him so well, because Tyler Hoechlin can bumble.
Yeah.
Whereas Henry Cavill is very dry. Like, I think Henry Cavill would be a very good Batman because of his humor.
Yeah, like, I honestly think he would be a better Batman than Superman. Or, like, there was this one idea I heard of, like, maybe he should have been Lex Luthor. Because I think that dry sense of humor could work, too. But, like, I was thinking, like, with Superman, like, the more bubbling humor is something more Clark Kent. And the more witty, like, repartee is more Superman. But, like, there's crossover, of course. Anyway, we'll talk about... We already did our big reboot of the DCEU years a while ago.
Yeah. Okay. So, hang on. Let me go back to your primer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Ashman's still alive. Oh, you do actually have some stuff with Angelique's backstory.
Yeah. So...
Which fits in pretty well with my stuff, actually. So, you go.
What I was thinking with Angelique is that long before she meets Solo, she... is a member of the French Resistance during World War II as a courier, saboteur, and thief. Very good at conning her way into spaces and cracking safes. After the war, she and Solo would encounter each other, start working together, fall in love for a time. They get busted. Angelique got away. Solo got busted. That's what he explains to the rest of the team. Angelique later reveals that her cell had been betrayed and got cornered in the catacombs of Paris, because the French Resistance used the catacombs all the time. And it'll turn out, Wolf's only met her recently. But it turns out, they had an encounter during this whole betrayal thing back during World War II. So he was there at the time, decides, then and there, I'm going to test out my new weapon on these saboteurs. Angelique manages to get away, but she vows revenge. I was also thinking that she... sort of like how Gabby is revealed to be a British agent, I thought, like, what if Angelique's actually an agent for the Duzium Bureau. Okay, they weren't calling themselves the Duzium Bureau by this time. They haven't called themselves that since, like, before World War II. But that's what everybody calls the French intelligence agencies, is the Duzium Bureau. I don't know about that. I kind of more like her being a wild card.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I still want her to get revenge on Wolf.
Yeah, all of that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Here's my idea for Angelique.
Okay.
On top of all this. maybe we can finesse it. But I'm thinking that at some point, maybe not necessarily the how do you pronounce the bureau?
Duzium Bureau.
Maybe on top of the Duzium Bureau contacting her, maybe she was also contacted by Waverly, who is aware of her real name, April Dancer.
Oh!
So for those not in the know, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the show, had a spinoff called The Girl from U.N.C.L.E., and April Dancer was the protagonist of that. And I was sitting here thinking, what if we pulled an Elementary and combined our femme fatale with our other character?
She's our Irene Adler / Jamie Moriarty.
Exactly.
Huh, yeah, I actually like that.
I was thinking either her birth name is April Dancer and Angelique is a pseudonym, but Waverly found out the truth, or the other option I was thinking, maybe this one actually fits better, is that after the plant explodes, like, she meets with Waverly in secret because, like, she's still not able to fully commit to being the girl from U.N.C.L.E., but he does give her, like, papers and a fake passport and identity that lists her as April Dancer, so she can, like, still disappear if she needs to.
As April Dancer.
Yeah, but she's not necessarily working for them.
And I think for, like, later sequels, like, of course she's gonna come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, going back to the plant, like, initially I thought, like, of course the plant's gonna explode, but I'm like, wait, this is a chemical plant. If it explodes, this is real, real bad. So maybe, like, the tension isn't...
The tension is stopping the explosion, not outrunning it.
Yeah. So, like, again, like, that's where we can have, like, Elaine have, like, this big thing where she's able to, maybe not the bomb, but, like, she's able to, like, shut down the plant in a way that buys them time to defuse the bombs.
Yeah.
And then on the outside, when we have the big reveal that, don't worry, President Ashman is fine. Like, we could have him calling up, like, the Western Intimate Forces to secure the location and, like, deal with the Thrush goons.
I think that reveal should come...
This is all stuff I came up, like, right now.
I think that reveal should be earlier, though. Like, I think there should be, like...
Okay.
How to word this? The Arthrupal infiltrate the chemical plant... Ostensibly, as far as the audience knows, to get Elaine out.
Yeah.
But then, like, partway through, like, let's say they're confronted by Wolfgang von Wolfgang. Or... And then we get the reveal that Elaine has freed herself, and then, like, there's, like, someone gets on the walkie and tells Wolfie that the Natumban forces have the base plant surrounded. And then we, like, cut over to reveal that Ashman is alive and giving the orders. And then we can have the, like, flashback summation where it's, like, go through the flashback of them, like, talking to President Ashman's, like... It's, like, again, going back to a heist film, it's, like, how they're revealing that, actually, this wasn't the plan. This was the plan the whole time.
Yeah.
And so we reveal all that stuff. Then we have the final fight scene, which is basically just trying to hold off Wolfgang and his forces long enough on the inside so that Elaine has enough time to defuse the bombs before they explode.
Yeah. And then, yay, the day is saved. Western Intimba safely establishes its independence. President Ashman isn't... Well, this is when I had it planned, is like, Western Intimba is, like, still in the process of decolonization. I think, like, it's now, like, in the process of, like... It has, like, formally, politically decolonized, but in that, like, the colonial powers are gone.
It's formally and politically decolonized.
Yeah.
And they have established that they are, not only will they not take any guff from the former colonial powers, but they have the connections to enforce their stance on that.
Yes.
And again, that also ties in nicely with Solo and Ilya and Gab. Well, I guess, yeah, Gabby was already independent, but Solo and Ilya officially being independent of their agencies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, another thing we can put, not a hat in a hat, but tying these hats together. We can say that the reason Solo and Ilya are able to fully be devoted to U.N.C.L.E. is because U.N.C.L.E. now has enough funding from an unnamed source, and that unnamed source will be Angelique, who will, like, hand over basically a duffel bag of $1 billion that she was able to get away from Wolfgang von Wolfgang's accounts.
Yeah.
And in return, Waverly gives her the papers as April Dancer.
Yes. So now, officially, Uncle can, like, actually truly do stuff. And yay, the day is saved.
The day is saved. And so I think the only thing we need to figure out retroactively is the thruple of it all.
Yeah.
Because I feel like they should be... I feel like chased is the wrong word.
Yeah, like...
I feel like all of their stuff should be, like...
Sex in movies is hard.
Sex, yeah, I mean, I'm all for sex in movies, but I feel like just the style and tone of this one, it would be very awkward if all of a sudden there was, like, a James Bond level of horniness to it. Like, I feel like this is... Not to say queerbaiting is good, but there's a certain level of homoerotic subtextual fun that comes from the concept of queerbaiting. And so, and probably why a lot of people are won over by it, because it's the... It's like jazz, okay? It's the notes that you don't play. which is a silly sentence to say, but I do believe that in several contexts it works, and I think this is one of them, where a lot of the appeal of the three of them being together would be the cheekiness of it.
Yeah.
I don't want there to be a scene where they look at each other like, because the three of us are dating each other simultaneously. I think the horniest thing should get is maybe like a scene at the end where they all head into the same hotel room or something. Like, they all head into the same hotel bedroom.
Yeah.
And that's, like, the final scene of the movie.
Yeah.
And then I guess also, just to make it to actual text, there should at the very least be a scene, probably during the climax, where, like, I'm thinking, Gabby kisses Solo for luck.
Yeah.
Pun. Reference! And then Ilya will go, what about me? And then Solo will kiss Ilya for luck. And not even ironically, Ilya will, thank you, cowboy.
Yes. Yeah, because, like, if I were to, like, turn this into, like, something a bit more full, like, I would have more scenes, firstly with Gabby and Solo, like, one-on-one, to, like, establish that they have, like, a thing going on, too. Or, like, they have some sort of repartee.
Yeah. Well, I think what you've set up does kind of naturally lead to that, just because Ilya has the more personal connection to Wolf Boy, then Gabby and Solo will by default kind of be the other dynamic duo. And so I think the best way to help further that would be give Moon Boy, no, that's not even close to this fake name that I made up, give Wolf Boy. You give Wolf Boy a second in command, and he's the guy that Gabby and Solo have to deal with during the climax.
Yeah, some other guy, like...
That can be Daniel Radcliffe.
Just a fucked up little weirdo.
We'll give him an eye patch. Everybody'd love an eye patch.
Yeah. Tell him to...
It's just for show. It gets ripped... It's just for show. It gets ripped off on the final battle, and Solo is so put out. He holds it up and is like, what is the point of this?
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, so I think we got a requel for the Man from U.N.C.L.E.
We did it!
Yay! Guy Ritchie, if you're listening.
Guy Ritchie, hire us. What was the film studio that made it? Warner Brothers.
Oh God.
License out the novel rights.
Yes.
Warner Brothers, I know you're against art, but...
Please. Yeah, that's another conversation for another day. We need to reboot Warner Bros.
That's too much in there. We could make a whole podcast about just individually rebooting separate Warner Bros. Films.
Yeah.
So, I guess we have reached the end of the podcast. So, Lindsay, where can people find you on the internet?
So, I'm on Blue Sky at LindsayM476. It's Lindsay spelled with an A at... blueski.social. Tanner, where can people find you?
You can find me on Blue Sky at sparkyupstart.bisky.social, and you can also find this very podcast on Blue Sky, but don't ask me where, because I haven't made the account yet.
We're getting there.
But by the time this episode goes up, it should be in the show notes. Yeah, and honestly, there's a very good chance that the account will be niiryfpod.bluesky.social, which are the letters for Not If I Reboot You First. And for a special podcast, they're not having a very special day.
You can also email us at notifireboot.you.first@gmail.com, where you can send us your comments, critiques, criticisms, and your vintage slash pairings.
Tell us all of the shows from the 60s that had a The Premise.
Yeah.
That email is also where you can send us a friendship promo, whether it's an audio clip or a proof for us to read. Either way, we'll put in a free ad for your podcast or YouTube or even your new spy agency. Pretty much all of the friendship promos we have right now are out of date, so like, we're working on building up a new bank of them before we start promoting them, but that means, hey, the sooner you get in, the sooner we're going to promote your thing.
Yeah. Not If I Ever Bit You First is a member of the Corner Podcast Network, and you can talk more about this show or others on the network via our Corner Podcast Discord. That's the one thing that hasn't changed!
And as always, our cover art is by Alex Pearson, who can be found on PTCHEW.com, and our theme music is done by Sean Clay, whose contact info is available upon request.
This podcast is recorded on Treaty 4 territory, the traditional lands of the Cree, Salt of Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota, and homeland of the Métis.
And finally, this podcast proudly stands with Palestine and always will. And next week is a guest episode!
Yay!
It is our first guest of the new podcast era, and they're a new guest. And remember, we're not doing hints anymore, because that shot us in the foot too many times. Yep. We're prepared this time. So next week, our friend Riss has prepared for us a reboot of some or all or at the very least 3/4 of My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yay!
So we will find out how the root of this podcast is Greek, but not if we reboot you first.
Bye!